Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, former Pennsylvania State House Speaker Bill DeWeese, who went to prison on corruption charges, talks criminal justice reform. But up front, the 2020 presidential election was one of, if not the most controversial in U.S. history. Former President Donald Trump continues to claim he won the election over now President Joe Biden, and fraud was rampant, especially with mail-in ballots. Some 60 court cases and other investigations found no fraud to speak of, and some have gone as far as saying the election was operated better than any other before it. A recent poll of Pennsylvanians by the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion found a significant amount of skepticism and examples of the great divide in this country. Joining us is Dr. Christopher Borick, professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College's Institute of Public Opinion. Dr. Borick, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Scott. It's wonderful to be back.
There's lots of information in this poll. Is there anything that stuck out to you?
Yeah, as you mentioned, it's a pretty packed poll in terms of findings and regarding Pennsylvanians' perceptions of the last election. And the takeaway, you know, one, as a political scientist, that about a third of Pennsylvanians in mid-December when we were fielding this said that they weren't confident in the results of the election. That's astounding, you know, when you think about it in the broader context of American elections, that you'd have about a third of the population with significant doubts about the legitimacy of the outcome. And of course, you know, that type of belief, if you will, has played an enormous role in what happened last month in Washington, and then the continued level of unrest that we have in our republic.
Broken down even further, the poll showed that a majority of Republicans, 68% of Republicans, do not have any confidence in the accuracy of the election, while 82% of Democrats and 56% of independents are very confident the results were accurate. You know, Chris, we have people in the two major parties that are living in different worlds.
That's a great way to say it, Scott. They are right now, and in my lifetime, which is getting more considerable all the time in terms of years, there's nothing like this. I mean, we've had rancor, we've had a division, but on kind of core fundamental principles like the legitimacy of an election, this is new terrain in contemporary American life, and those numbers that you cited are so striking that you see that the percentages, as you said, a solid majority of Republicans without confidence, while, you know, a very strong majority of Democrats with confidence in this particular election, and independents leaning also to in more confident than not confident, is just a real signal about how divided we are and how the underlying acceptance of our electoral process in the Commonwealth is right now in debate, which is, again, we can go deep into that, how problematic it is for us as a country.
Joe Biden has called from day one of his presidency, which is just about 2 weeks old now, has called for unity. I have to say that that seems like an awful challenge, Chris, when you see, now this is just one question here, but when you see that kind of division, you wonder how the country can come together.
It is a Herculean challenge, and I think President Biden in his past has had lots of experience with bipartisanship as someone that spent so much time in the Senate working out bipartisan deals, and I think he believes in it and will continue to both in policy efforts and rhetorical efforts reach out for some bipartisanship. But when you have, and again, this is, we could see this evolving over time, you know, are some of these views, but when you see the deep-seated beliefs on the ultimate legitimacy of his presidency among people across the aisle, you know, rank and file Republicans in the country, it certainly makes that challenge all the more difficult. And how do you reach out? If you don't try, it's not going to happen. So how he approaches that, and I think he is continually looking to that, but there's no doubt that challenge is extremely hard and difficult right now. And trying to make that pitch, if you will, maybe, you know, as we often say, start small, find ways to build that and move forward. But the steep nature of that hill is pretty clear.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Chris, one of the big differences here, too, had to do with mail-in balloting. The state was divided on potential limiting of the use of mail-in ballots in future elections. 51% disagreeing with limiting the method of voting, thinking that it should be able to mail-in balloting should continue. 47% agreeing that limits to mail voting should be put in place. I mean, granted, this is a new law. There have been states around the country been doing this for a long time. But there seems to be at least half the voting public out there that doesn't have a lot of confidence in mail-in balloting.
Indeed. I mean, that division, again, is so stark. You could find that in so many parts of the results of the survey, Scott. And that one is, of course, incredibly salient in terms of the contemporary debates going on in the Capitol regarding the future of elections and election security in the state. And you know, less than 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, when that law was passed to expand this, it wasn't the controversial topic that it is right now. But again, in many ways, last fall in Pennsylvania, in particular, mail-in ballots became the focal point of a lot of the debates and critiques and criticisms of election security. So it's probably not surprising that you see, you know, that high 40% mark for people that said there should be some limits moving forward. And that, you know, when you break that down again, it falls along partisan lines, with Republicans being much more likely to want that and Democrats opposed. And of course, that's driving some of the energy that we see in the series of hearings taking place in Harrisburg about election reform in the state. And it's become part of the process, and it's going to be, I imagine, a point that Republicans want to find ways to rein in, given that we see such strong support among Republicans throughout the state for some type of limits. And so you'll certainly see that prominently displayed in part of the push that's happening for a change in election procedures in the state.
We have an email from a listener, Carl, who says, you know, talks about why states such as Oregon have been successful using mail-in voting for decades, yet Republicans in Pennsylvania seem to be going out of their way to sabotage a process that increases voter participation. And that kind of goes along with, you know, not accusing Republicans of sabotaging it, but just goes along with what you were just saying, Chris, that Republicans seem skeptical of this right now. Want to go on to some other things in the poll. When we're talking about this division, it's not just between Republicans and Democrats. College graduates and those who don't have a bachelor's degree, people who voted in person and those who voted by mail, even a division between men and women, that the poll showed that there are different opinions and widely different opinions amongst all those groups. I mean, again, it's just not a division of Republicans and Democrats. For example, confidence in the result of the election was greatly different with respect to educational backgrounds. A majority of voters with a bachelor's degree, this is 72%, were confident that the results of the election were accurate, while a majority of voters without a degree, 51%, not confident in the accuracy of the results. Chris, this is a divide that was first maybe became noticeable in 2016 with the election of President Trump, but it continues to be a real divide in this state and in the country.
It is so true, Scott. That divide has grown over the last 4 years. It certainly really came to prominence in 2016 during President Trump's first election when he was elected as president. And it is part of now Pennsylvania politics and national politics, of course. But as we see in Pennsylvania, those divides are stark and growing. Among educated individuals, and even when you break it down, people with college attainment and those without college degrees, those divides are so big, and you break it down, that's internally, you see it within parties also, and goes so deep. I mean, I wish we had lots of time. You look at the use of media sources where people are getting information, that of course is also affected by your level of educational attainment, and so where you might be finding information about politics, about issues, about the election, certainly is affected by that. But there's no doubt about it. At any time in my life, and I've been studying Pennsylvania politics, for a quarter of a century, we never saw divides on this particular dimension, do you have a degree or not, like we're seeing right now in Pennsylvania. And that's mirroring a lot of what's happening nationally. That divide continues to grow.
Even those who voted by mail and those who voted in person, there was a big difference. That, first of all, men were more likely to vote in person than women. Those who voted by mail had greater confidence in the accuracy of the election as opposed to those who voted in person. I keep bringing up these divisions, Chris, but the poll keeps showing that there are so many out there.
I know, and it is, you look for places for unity, and there are a few, concerns that we saw when we asked people about, social media and its the types of information that come out of social media. We see broad levels of distrust and concern expressed across, but the divisions are much more common than the commonalities, if you will, Scott. And that's it. And there's an overlay, right? When you start thinking, well, who's most likely to vote by mail? It was Democrats. Democrats, we have a gender gap in Pennsylvania, like we do in a lot of other places where women are more likely to be Democrats right now. And so you see some of these divisions, that go back to our partisan divide, but they are amplified in their own particular ways. And we see that in terms of people that experience, obviously, people that voted by mail last year are more confident. They like it. They don't want to see it taken away. Those that didn't are much more distrusting of it. And that overlays again with their partisanship and their broader political standing, but very clear, these divides, as we start looking across educational attainment, across gender, across region, of course, across partisanship, are real, pronounced, and part of our electoral picture and our picture as a commonwealth right now. It's very much a defining when we look back at this time. I think this will be one of the features that is most commonly described or used to describe the period.
Not election related, but some opinions on several issues and institutions in the poll. The Black Lives Matter movement remains a highly partisan issue. 81% of Democrat respondents held a favorable opinion concerning the movement, while 71% of Republicans had an unfavorable opinion. Also worth noting, and this is your words, from the release. Also worth noting is that among independent voters, 54% favored Black Lives Matter to some degree, while only 25% viewed it unfavorably. Another finding, despite the fact that court systems have become more politicized in recent years, a majority of Democrats, Republicans, and independents still trust the highest court in Pennsylvania. However, Republicans are significantly more likely to distrust the court. And along those lines, Chris, we have a question about the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. This is from a listener who said, could you comment on the appropriateness of the state Supreme Court setting policy for the return and opening of mail-in ballots? I'm not sure if they had anything to do with the fixing of incorrectly submitted ballots. I thought the court could only rule on the state constitution and laws related to the election, not changing procedures on the fly. This is one of the cries of Republicans in this state. So your thoughts on the listener's question and also those results on Black Lives Matter and the courts.
Yeah, well, I'll start with the courts, Scott. And indeed, you know, we saw that the courts, compared to other institutions, other individuals, tend to still have higher levels of trust among the electorate in Pennsylvania. This has been historically common, the courts compared to legislatures and executives, governors, presidents, Congress, state house, state legislature, get better views. That was once again on display in this survey, but clearly those partisan divides we've talked about in terms of trust and views of the institution are affected. Republicans are far less likely to have trust in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court right now than Democrats. That hasn't always been the case, but clearly is right now. I'll just step back a little bit on that for a second. The courts, it's important that levels of trust, even modestly higher among Republicans than it would be for other institutions, and clearly high among Democrats and independents, was very crucial, I think, in you know, as we moved through this election that we eventually got the result that we did, that there was at least some degree of confidence that the courts can step in. And the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, had fairly high marks in this survey. So that institution, certainly compared to others, remains in a better position, both at the state and federal level. And Black Lives Matter, BLM, you know, over the last year, we've seen polls move last few years from having a fairly negative view to a much more positive view in terms of public acceptance that peaked in many ways last summer after the George Floyd murder and kind of public reactions. But I guess clearly it's not a surprise that those views are very much tied to our partisanship, like so many other things, with support for that movement much less among Republicans than among independents and Democrats in the state.
Chris, I got to ask this question. You are probably the first pollster I have had on the program since the election. And, you know, one of the things that did come out was, especially when it came to the presidential race, is that the polls, again, weren't very accurate around the country as far as the Trump and Biden. I guess the question has to be, is there something that you have to change? Or maybe I should just ask, why should people have confidence in these polls?
Sure. It's a very legitimate question, Scott. And when you go back and you look at the last cycle, there certainly were some big misses in the polls. Places like Wisconsin, we saw some really big differences between the election pre-election polls and the final result. Just to note, you saw a lot of places where the polls were very accurate, especially in a lot of swing states like Georgia, Arizona, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania, which I could speak most clearly to. The polls did, like they did in 2016, overstate the Democratic candidates' leads. You know, the final averages were in the low single digits. Joe Biden won by 1.2%. So they were a little bit over. It certainly is important for the whole polling and public opinion research field to really evaluate what happened. One interesting thing, you know, we did the last two, the elections where we've seen in Pennsylvania the largest kind of miss, if you will, in terms of overstating Democratic performance was when President Trump was on the ballot, 2016, 2020. The midterm elections of 2018, the polls were fairly, it was a good cycle, fairly accurate. It really is interesting to look if there is a particular effect of President Trump in terms of elections. There's a lot of discussion of this in the polling world, if you will, right now. And is there something unique there? The polls, for example, after the latest example we had was the Georgia special elections. They were dead on in those polls. So lots to consider, lots to talk about. And certainly have to take the long view. How do they compare over time? We've seen historically some polls, cycles that were better than others. And where are we right now? So Holt, lovely discussion. I'd be happy to come back
I'm sure we will have that discussion again. Dr. Christopher Borick is professor of political science and director of Muhlenberg College's Institute of Public Opinion. Chris Borick, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Scott. Stay safe.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Former Pennsylvania Speaker of the House Bill DeWeese, a Democrat from Greene County in southwestern Pennsylvania, was once one of the most powerful politicians in this state. That was until he was charged with using his state office staffers and a consultant to work on political matters on state time. It's been almost a decade since DeWeese was found guilty of felony counts of theft, conflict of interest, and conspiracy. DeWeese was sentenced to 30 to 60 months in prison and served just under 2 years. He was released in 2014. Today, Bill DeWeese is talking about criminal justice reform, especially during this time of the COVID-19 pandemic. Bill DeWeese, welcome to the program. You've been out of jail, and I doubt you would say free, for almost 7 years. During those years, criminal justice reform is what you've talked about in many public settings. What did you see in prison that made you want to address criminal justice reform?
Well, first, the racial divide, the mass incarceration of Black and brown individuals was so stark. I'd been to Africa on a handful of occasions, and when the first day in the yard appeared in front of me, it just seemed as if I were in Lagos or Nairobi or Dar es Salaam. And I really mean that. It was exceedingly stark. Of the 1,200 men that I was with, approximately 800 were African Americans and 100 were Puerto Ricans. And it was an overwhelming realization that the book on the new Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in America, by Michelle Alexander, the Ohio State University professor, was so, so accurate.
Well, the African Americans that were in prison, and you know, there's been a lot of attention on mass incarceration, probably more so since last year with George Floyd. But the people who were in jail, I mean, did they get sentences that were more than what their white counterparts would have gotten for similar crimes? Were these minor crimes that maybe they shouldn't have been in prison? Go ahead.
I would say, Scott, that so many of these young people, and when you're in your 60s in a medium security state penitentiary, everybody seems young. Virtually 95, 96, 97% of the population was younger than I was, but they were in there for innumerable reasons. But part of it, a big part of it, was technical violations. Another part was the fact they could not reach bail. Third situation was their educational attainments were so limited that if they had gotten out, they weren't able to sustain a job setting, and they resorted to what got them there in the first place. So there were a lot of factors. I would have to think that the icing on the cake, if we were ever to solve this problem, would be education. And I guess one collateral thing was about 70-80% of the folks that I was with did not have their high school or GED, and about 70-80% of the folks that I was with did have a alcohol or drug problem.
Before we get into, because you have some recommendations for reform, and I want to talk about those, especially during the pandemic. You maintain your innocence from the very beginning, saying that you didn't authorize bonuses or campaign or political work on state time, and said it was a political vendetta by former Pennsylvania Attorney General and who became Governor Tom Corbett. A jury didn't agree. But what did you see during your own experiences with the criminal justice reform, and maybe even in your trial, that should have been different, that was in need of reform?
Well, with all due respect, I'm going to take a page from Professor Christopher Borick, and that would be another opportunity. I'm still under appellate avenues, and I think it would be inappropriate for me to talk about my own case. But I do think that there were so many areas for reform that I saw then, and I still project now, primarily after I got incarcerated. But the big one was the technical violations. A very sturdy percentage of the young men that I was with had come back into a big state correctional facility because they had a 2-4 on a drug case. They got out after 2, but they were in a halfway house. They were apprehended with a 6-pack of beer or a cell phone, or they could not pass a drug test, and they were sent right back in to complete the extra 2 years that they had been sentenced to originally. So 2+2. And if you were out on the street for 3 months, that did not count. So technical violations was something that I think we need to take another look at, especially when it costs $40,000 to $45,000 per year to keep somebody in a setting like that. And if you're over the age of 50, which of course I was, it's about $60,000 a year to keep someone in that kind of a setting. So I think it's something that the costs should be considered. And the monitoring in the current world with ankle bracelets would be such that if you got a 2-4 on a minor drug case and got out, and they did catch you with a cell phone in the halfway house, which is prohibited at a certain length of time, then give you a warning or put another 6 months on your halfway house or send you home and into a job with an ankle bracelet. But I just think that was one of the things, technical violations. And the second one would be bail reform. Each county has its own philosophy and its own predicament on bail reform. And so many of these youngsters don't have enough money to pay bail while their case is being at least initially overseen by the authorities. So they languish in jail, which is an appropriate segue into the fact that we have so many people right now in county and state facilities, and that's adding to this pandemic that we have with our COVID-19.
Well, speaking, okay, there are a lot of segues there, but the one I'm going to choose here, Representative DeWeese, is co-pays, medical co-pays. These are probably some things that many people aren't aware of in the public. Medical co-pays in state prisons. What happens there that an inmate is charged for when they need treatment, when they're sick or something like that, right? In fact, you had, from what I understand, you had an experience yourself with that.
Yes, I had a rash on my back, and I still have that rash on my back because the department refused to allow me to see a dermatologist. They did, after many months of supplication, allow for a screen to be set up in the infirmary, and a dermatologist looked at my back and recommended the same kind of ointment, I believe, that I was using. But notwithstanding that, if you're making 19 cents an hour, and I'm sure that the general population would think that's probably appropriate for cutting the grass or working in the laundry or working in the chow hall, you're only bringing in 15, 18, 20, 23, 25 bucks a month. And if you go to the infirmary, it's a $5 cost off the top. Now, to the credit of the Department of Corrections, they have taken that cost away during the pandemic. But inherently, if you have a problem, it can be exacerbated by the fact that many of these young men don't have any money coming in from the outside. and they usually do have some sort of a menial job within the facility. But I would say the average amount of money coming in per month would be $20-$25. So the $5 copay every time you go down was substantial. Now, Philadelphia, to their credit, does not have a copay. Other counties have their own systems, and that would be variegated.
You said yourself that there may be people in the public who think that 19 cents an hour is appropriate. There may be people out there who also would look at it and say, well, they're in prison. They committed a crime, and I pay a copay when I go to the doctor. Why shouldn't an inmate, prison inmate, pay $5 per visit to the doctor?
I understand that perspective, and I accept that point of view. I'm only saying that the men that I was with for approximately 23 months were destitute. These youngsters had nothing. And if they were making 20 or 25 bucks a month working in the laundry, working in the landscaping of the facility, working in the chow hall, then that was probably 1/4 of everything they were going to get that month. And they had a commissary situation where they had to buy soap and toothpaste and laundry and so forth. And again, I do accept the perspective that you just enunciated, but nevertheless, I happen to think that a copay should be revisited. And even if it were reduced to $250 instead of $5, I was there for 23 months. I saw a lot of people who would not go down even when they were sick. And of course, that sickness could potentially lead to something more aggravating and more serious.
Also, and I want to know if this is just during the pandemic, but every time a parole officer comes to your house, you're charged for the ankle bracelet, and it's difficult to find jobs to pay for a parole person?
Yes, I think that especially with some of the more recent legislation that Jordan Harris and Joanna McClinton, our own Central Pennsylvania Cheryl DeLozier, others have projected with the clean slate, misdemeanor charges after 10 years with good behavior would be expunged and a job would be easier. But when you get out of prison, it's very, very difficult to get a job. And if you are having to pay for the ankle bracelet, having to pay for costs and fines that were never completed, and paying for the parole person to come by occasionally, whenever he or she wanted to, of course, to administer drug tests and urinalysis for drinking and so forth, you are really hammered. And right now with COVID-19, the whole processes, whether it's the magisterial courts or the courts of common pleas, they are jammed up. So we have more people being incarcerated and fewer people coming out the other end. And when you are that crowded, naturally, the chances for COVID are enhanced. We've had 4,065 staff people. I did some math here within the last 2 days. 4,065 staff people have to confront COVID with a positive test, and 9,200 incarcerated. And if you're in a nursing home, at least the door will close completely. In a cell block, obviously, you either have bars or you have a large metal door with a big steel mesh window. So the circulation is impossible to contravene. We've had 103 inmates die. We've had 11 staff die. And our challenges within the Department of Corrections, which I have respect for. In fact, I wrote a song, which I will share sometime in another setting, but the essence of that song is I have a respect for the Department of Corrections, but they have a 3 times higher incident of challenging during these COVID-19 moments, especially of death, compared to the general public. So even though people did something wrong, if you are a petty drug dealer in Greene County or Steelton or Philadelphia, you didn't deserve a death penalty. So I really think they're doing their best, but it is very tough. And I'm not so sure there is an easy answer. But if we don't lock up people again on technical violations, that would take down a hefty percentage of the people that are being reincarcerated. And if you change the bail system, that would also make a number two effort to reduce some of the population. We have more people incarcerated per capita than any country in the world, unless South Africa is still a competitor, but I don't think they are. I think we're number one, which is an ignominious distinction.
I don't know, Representative, I think you may have to have a better hook on that song for I Have Respect for the Correction System for it to become a bestseller.
I will share it with your producer when we're off the air.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, our guest during this portion of the program is former Pennsylvania House Speaker Bill DeWeese talking about criminal justice reform. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@WITF.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. One of the things you talking about the pandemic, one of the things I know that you recommended is that guards be put in the 1A category for getting vaccinations. Why?
Well, again, in a nursing facility, they have the opportunity to close the doors, to regulate. I don't know that there are all that many dynamics that are parallel with a nursing facility or a big incarceration facility, a big state prison. But the state prison has no ability to deal with the air circulation. And I just think that the staff, not only the guards, but the air conditioning people, the electricity folks, the people that oversee the chow hall, the sports people, anybody, they have the right to be protected. And they're coming in contact with all kinds of people on the outside. And when they bring it in, again, there are 1,200 people at the facility that I was at. I would say there are a lot of facilities with 2,000 to 3,000 people. So I would give the personnel at the DOC a very high priority relative to getting inoculations.
45,000 people incarcerated in the state. You mentioned that most of them.
No. That's only in the state facilities.
Okay, that's not the counties.
75,000.
Right.
Yes, if you count the county prisons.
Right. But you mentioned that most of those who are incarcerated are young. But there are some older inmates as well, some who have been sentenced to life in prison. You think that some of those older inmates maybe should be released, correct?
I think that, yes, some, absolutely. But I think the percentages are approximately 10%. I think there are about 45,000 individuals incarcerated in Pennsylvania State Correctional Facilities, and about 4,500 of them are doing life. I would offer, from my own experience of almost 2 years, that if someone has been there for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, and again, it would not be uncommon if there was a murder and you were 20 and now you're 70 and you have a malignancy, you have COVID-19, you have diabetes, you're in a wheelchair, that at least the authorities at the parole board and the governor's office and the lieutenant governor's office would at least take another look. And of course, the victims' families have to be involved in this dynamic, but in many cases, they are. And in many cases, people with second degree murder charges, people that were in the getaway car, people that were in the car and they didn't realize that the person inside the 7-Eleven was going to be shot in the activity that went on inside, et cetera. I think at least these cases need to be reviewed. And State Senator Tony Williams is offering legislation as we speak for elderly release on medical parole. And again, I hope that it will be given a solid overview by the 50 members of the Pennsylvania Senate. I think that in history, we've had under Governor Schaap hundreds and hundreds of people given commutations, and going all the way back to Pearl Harbor and beyond into the dim mists of history, it was not uncommon for people to get commutations. I remember Haley Barbour the governor of Mississippi and the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. When he left the governor's mansion in Mississippi, he commuted the sentences of six lifers who had been doing work in the governor's mansion his whole tenure, whether it was in the yard or in his kitchen or as his helpers in other settings. And I really think that we have to have a new approach, especially when people are infirm and have already done 20, 30, 40, 50 years. I will say real quickly that a few years after I was released, I drove from Greene County to Philadelphia and participated as one of three people on behalf of a juvenile lifer named Jose Alamo. And Jose and I were on the same block, and we walked the yard together. I knew him well. He was in his middle teens, and he was involved in a gang shooting dynamic where a handful of kids, young people, were on one side of the street and other people were on the other side of the street, and a little 15-year-old girl was caught in the crossfire, and she was killed. Ballistics proved that it was not Jose's weapon, but he was doing 24 years at that point on a second-degree charge. And when the United States Supreme Court, Miller versus Alabama, said that all juveniles get a second hearing, an additional hearing, just a hearing. Well, that Philadelphia judge found out that day, and the victims' families were there, and so were the people from the Department of Corrections through recommendations and so forth. Well, Jose is one of a handful of juvenile lifers who's now been given a second chance. He was on an ankle bracelet for a long, long time, and now he's working as a clerk in a law firm.
Okay, so that you anticipated my next question. I was going to ask what Jose was doing today, because when people, again, hear the details of that crime, their compassion, level of compassion may go down a little bit when they hear that a little girl was killed.
Yes, absolutely, and I understand that. I absolutely understand that. And society has to make that call. But for 24 years, Jose Alamo had zero write-ups. He had been a model person in there, and he had had a very, very tough childhood. In fact, he didn't have a familial structure at all. And the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas judge, she decided that after 24 years with no write-ups, she was going to give him another chance. But again, out of 45,000 people, 4,500 lifers, he would be in a group of 20, 30, 40, 50 people. And in the recent commutation effort, and I mean recent, within the last year, year and a half, 18 names went up. And when I say went up, they were recommended by the guards, by the wardens, by the counselors, by everyone. And the Attorney General, Joshua Shapiro, voted against 16 out of the 18. So there are not very many people being released from our state facilities because the political dynamics are seemingly inflexible.
I had a question from a guest. Wanted to know, do inmates ever get a letter of reference when they leave prison?
Well, that's an interesting question, and the answer would be yes, because Jose not only had Bill DeWeese there on his behalf, but he had the librarian of the State Correctional Institution there, and Jose had worked in the library for years and years. So he was a beneficiary of that. I am blessed to be on the board of directors of the Pennsylvania Prison Society, based in Philadelphia and founded by Benjamin Franklin, I might add, the oldest civil rights organization in the world. And we do help our folks every time we get a chance. And we certainly help Jose, because one of the board members is the person who has helped Jose get a new start on life. And I might add, he recently got married and he's going to have a family. He was only in his middle 40s when he got out. So he does have a chance. And I would have trusted Jose with my aging mother at the Masonic Village, because that's just the way I was able to read people. And I think more people need a chance. That's all.
We have an email here from a person who was formerly incarcerated. It says, I fully agree with this conversation. Hard to get income after getting out of prison. People deserve second chances. Try to get back in the community after serving time. Then you run into circumstances that you find it hard to land a job. Sometimes no means or no family support. It's even worse with COVID-19. This seems to be exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Let's see. We have another question here from listener wants to know, are family or outside individuals allowed to pay for copays?
Well, yes, they have a J-Pay. I guess the J stands for jail, but they can send in money through the computer and put money on the books. So whether it's a bag of peanuts or a new pair of flip-flops or toothpaste or your copay, absolutely, yes. And I might add that of the five people on my block that I bonded with the most, I still keep in touch with all five, including Jose, and the other four I'm helping in other ways. So their copay circumstances certainly are not difficult for them. I'm helping them financially.
Former Speaker of the Pennsylvania House, Bill DeWeese, I enjoyed our conversation. I know we've been a long time trying to get this together. How about we do it again?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Scott Lamar.
All right. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Toward Racial Justice, WITF series of virtual community conversations produced to address systemic racism in central Pennsylvania and beyond. It returns tonight at 7 on WITF's YouTube channel. Series moderator Charles Ellison is executive producer and host of Reality Check on WURD in Philadelphia. And he's with us today to talk about the goals of Toward Racial Justice in the new years and talk about the program in the past. Mr. Ellison, thank you very much for being with us today. If for someone who has not heard Toward Racial Justice, how would you describe the program?
Right. Hey, thanks for having me. Good morning. So Toward Racial Justice is really about how we carve out a path towards total equity, towards total parity. You know, we're having some very difficult, sometimes uncomfortable conversations about race, about racism. But the whole goal is, okay, well, how do we make these conversations actionable so we can eliminate racism? Because I think that is, as it's always been said, the original sin of America. It is something that plagues us to this day. And it's the root cause of a lot of problems that we're dealing with as a country. We have to eliminate it. We have no choice. It's an existential threat. So, you know, really, it's more than just a conversation here towards racial justice. It's really transcending the conversation, and it's us exploring creative ways to essentially manage and mitigate and eliminate eventually racism. And so, you know, this is what we're going to have to do. We're going to have some real difficult conversations and kind of cut through a lot of trauma that we're all going through as a collective community. But we also have to understand and we have to assess the traumas that BIPOC populations, Black, Indigenous, people of color, have gone through for many centuries in this country. And we have to resolve that.
We only have about 2 minutes, but I did want to talk about what are some of the topics that you're looking to address here in 2021?
Right. You know, definitely we want to talk about the pandemic, and we want to talk about, you know, a lot of the inequities that we've seen that have been unveiled as a result of that pandemic. You know, we want to talk about, you know, especially with respect to Pennsylvania and what vulnerable, historically marginalized populations in central PA have been dealing with, you know, issues like education, policing. We need to have a discussion about that. About the economic situation, you know, we're going to revisit a lot of those issues, those social justice issues that we talked about in 2020, because they're still unresolved and they're still just as relevant and just as, you know, high profile in 2021. You know, we're also, you know, going to talk about health and, you know, and economics and, you know, sort of where we are as a state moving forward. On issues also dealing with, you know, the environment is also going to be a major thing that we're going to be discussing later on. So there are a number of issues we're going to kind of, just like how we did in 2020, you know, people may feel like in 2021 is sort of a rehash of some of those issues from last year. But, you know, we believe that these are issues that are necessary and essential to talk about.
We only have about 30 seconds left. I hate to restrict you to that amount of time, but what makes Toward Racial Justice unique?
You know, I think it's, you know, one, definitely the emphasis on central Pennsylvania, I think definitely makes us unique because it's, you know, there have been these populations, these communities that have lived in central PA for a long time that have felt marginalized and alienated, and giving them voice. And so that's something that we have never really seen happen before. I'm learning a lot from that process as that's happening, you know, particularly as someone based out of Philadelphia, and learning more about, you know, those communities on the in the center of, and on the other side of the state. I think that's just really profound, you know, that we're kind of enlightening folks to those struggles.
Charles Ellison leads the discussion on Toward Racial Justice. It returns tonight at 7 on WITF's YouTube channel. Go to our website, WITF.org, to participate. But Charles Ellison, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hey, thanks so much. You all take care.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great week.